kidding.
All right, we'll open the Ways and Means Committee hearing for Wednesday, January 26th. We're going to hear a little public safety overview as it pertains to the governor's budget, and then after a speedy, thoughtful discourse and dialogue, we'll move on to all other programs in a whole another hour after that. So nothing like giving thoughtful consideration to the governor's hard work. So why don't we have the public safety members come forward, please. Campbell, you can start right now.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, first of all, thank you for giving us the opportunity to come and talk to you today about an overview of the governor's public safety budget. What we're going to be doing today is we're going to be taking you through initially the principles and the programs as an overview, and then we're going to get into the details of the numbers. I'll be taking you through the first part, and then those who know the numbers intimately will take you through the part that will require some level of knowledge and expertise. So to begin with, I'll go ahead and start off with the governor's public safety principle. As you know, the governor built his budget around six different principles. I'm sure you've heard many of them already in the presentations that have preceded this one. The public safety principle is that Oregonians are safe in their homes, communities, and state institutions. That principle, of course, is broken down into seven separate elements that we used as we were building the budget in the governor's budget safety, or the overall budget process. The first of those principles, of course, is that public safety is essential. I'm sure that's no surprise to any of us. That criminals must be held accountable for their actions. That prevention is a priority. That recidivism must be reduced. That safe buildings and workplaces must be provided. That fraud and abuse are prevented, and that Oregon is prepared for and responds swiftly to emergencies. Now, I do want to identify that certainly those safety principles expand beyond those agencies that we'll be talking to you about funding issues around today. For instance, the Department of Transportation takes care of highway maintenance to keep roads safe, deals with driver and motor vehicle issues to make sure that those who are driving unsafe are taken off the roads or are provided adequate instructions so that when they're on the roads they drive safely. There are a number of licensing and regulatory programs that are used to prevent fraud and abuse. Programs within the Department of Consumer and Business Services, for instance, also deal with building codes and issues to make sure that when buildings are built in the state, they're done so in a safe manner. Those issues, of course, are ones that will be dealt with under other budgets, but I did want to let you know as we were constructing the governor's budget, we were cognizant of those particular agencies, and they were part of that principle as we proceeded.
Mr. Chair?
Question, Senator Gordon.
Thank you very much. Mr. Campbell, if you could, as you are working through the presentation and with the public safety principles in mind, I'm focusing on recidivism. Recidivism must be reduced. As you work your way through the presentation and where it's appropriate, could you identify those key pieces in the public safety budgets that are targeted to getting that result?
Madam Chair, Senator Gurley, I will endeavor to do so.
Okay. That means you're going to try.
Yes. Okay. To the extent they are present in this budget, I will endeavor to do so.
Which means that you can also tell us what isn't in the budget. Thank you.
The first of the governor's priorities that we wanted to make sure was met when we were putting together this budget is that we met the requirements that were under the Constitution, federal law, and that were imposed upon us by court case. Two of the biggest drivers there were, of course, that we needed to fully fund the forecasted growth in prison population to meet the ballot Measure 11 mandates, and that there's no early release in those particular issues, and then that we fully fund additional prison construction in order to meet that forecasted growth. I will make a side comment at this point in time that, as you've probably heard in previous presentations, when we built this budget, and I do refer to it as building the budget, we knew how much money we would have and we wanted to say what services we could buy with that money. But we also wanted to make sure we were doing so without borrowing, without additional taxes, and with an effort of sustainability so the programs we set in place now could sustain into the future, and that we would prioritize those existing resources to those programs we felt were most critical to the ongoing budget.
Mr. Chair?
Question, Senator Gordley.
Thank you. Mr. Campbell, we had this conversation when you met with me in my office, so the question won't come as a surprise. But could you talk about how comfortable the governor is that all creativity has been exhausted in looking at other alternatives to building new prisons, that we've looked at every possible available bed in the state with consideration to out of state as a less than desirable choice, but that we've exhausted all creativity in looking.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gridley, that's correct. When we are putting together this budget, and I give a great amount of credit to Max Williams, the director of the Department of Corrections, and his staff, they have done a pretty exhaustive job in identifying what alternatives there are to building additional prison space. The issues that they looked at is, one, the ability to manage our population, meaning those individuals, and this was specific to out-of-state, because once you send prisoners out-of-state, there are controls issues, and in the past we've had some problem in the dependability of the service outside the state, which we have very little control over. The second one is, of course, the cost of placing our incarcerated population in structures other than those that are our traditional corrections institutions. Specifically, if we can find a lower cost, doesn't it make more sense to put them there? But what we found is there are a number of cases where the cost is actually higher for a number of reasons. And the third being, of course, that we have certain requirements with our corrections incarcerated population that you have to have certain structural requirements met, for instance, the ability to do large muscle exercises and so forth, that most institutions that are alternatives, for instance, jails, were not really designed for. So mostly what we're looking at as far as placement outside of our corrections institutions are temporary placements to prevent or to deal with overflow. I'm very confident that the work that the Department of Corrections has done to this point in time has really been very comprehensive in looking at those alternatives.
And if I may follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
The work that was done, I'm assuming some studies, some documentation of what was looked at. Are those documents available to the entire committee, but particularly the Public Safety Committee?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gridley, we'll make sure that you get that information.
Yes, everything I've heard thus far has been, it's been verbal assurances, but I haven't seen any documentation that says this is what led to our conclusions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just a follow-up. I'm sorry, go ahead. Senator Winters, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And could you also provide us, if it exists, where perhaps we are actually accepting prisoners from other states, and if we are, how much they're paying us, and how many are we accepting from other states, and then could you give us a cost breakdown of if we were to send prisoners to under the compacts to other states, what those costs actually are. And it would also help us if you would include in that in the number of beds that are available in the various counties by county.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, I'd be happy to get that information. I don't know offhand whether we do, in fact, have inmates from other states, but to the extent we do, we'll get that information for you and the cost associated.
And the county number by county, I think, is very important. For example, if I looked at Polk County, how many beds are available for us, the same would be true. And a cost figure of what it would cost if we would have them there. Multnomah County, for example, because we know, you know, throughout the state, that would be very helpful.
Very good. We'd be happy to do that. Then, of course, the second priority is the one that I alluded to earlier, is investing remaining dollars to best achieve the principles to the long-term future of Oregon. The comment I want to make here is that this was a different exercise in that as a public safety system, we were trying to build the public safety system based on the resources that we had. And so that was the focus we really spent. We weren't looking at where do we cut. We were saying, where do we build this budget from? And as a prioritized issue, if the governor submitted a budget where that agency was fully funded as opposed to being reduced and not reflective of additions, but basically continuing where it was, that was a priority in the public safety budget. I'll touch very briefly on the fact that, as you know, we have identified lottery dollars to provide for the funding of a number of state trooper positions within the state's budget, and there's been a number of questions about what is the justification for doing so. The justification is based upon economic development. There are two sides where that argument comes into play. The first, of course, is the basic argument that if you are hiring troopers, you're creating jobs, and that's economic development. The other side, and I think more compelling, is that when businesses seek to come to Oregon, and we've had an awful lot of contact recently with businesses to try to attract them to Oregon, the argument that you have a more robust public safety system represented by adequate levels of troopers and law enforcement has been of concern to them when they make the decision as to whether or not to come to Oregon.
Mr. Chair?
You can honestly make that.
Well, thank you.
I did that very well. There's a question down here.
Well, I just want to say that is just such a stretch. That it's just, I just find it unacceptable. I know that that's the justification being described to us, but it just holds no water at all. It just doesn't.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gurley, I'm not sure if that was a question or not, but
it's a comment, and you've heard it before. Yeah.
Maybe we should move on.
Yeah.
Very good.
That's for the record.
And of course, the legislature is the ultimate arbiter of what they identify economic development for and how those dollars are used. So,
using gasoline tax.
We provided you with the budget, and we look forward to seeing that.
Oh, Senator Morissette, excuse me, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I heard on NPR that as I was driving up the other day about Governor Schwarzenegger's new policy in the state of California. He hired the woman who was the warden at San Quentin for 5 years and made her the director of corrections. And what he is saying is that we are going to put corrections back into correction, and that the purpose of the prison is to incarcerate people who have committed a crime, but not necessarily to punish them while they're there. And her program at San Quentin, which seemed to be very successful, was education. And so that is the new direction, apparently, that California is going. And that deals directly with recidivism. When people do get out, and they will get out at some point, that they have something to look forward to and they can be productive members of society. So I hope that you will be in touch, and I'm getting in touch with the director, Max Williams, to talk to him about this. Apparently he's talked with the corrections department, so I'm hoping that as the session goes along and we discuss the aspects of recidivism and preparing people, and whether our job is to punish people while they're there or to rehabilitate them. And I think we don't quite know that answer. I mean, we have mixed signals. So I just wanted to mention that to you and hope that you will. Have you heard of this program?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, not specifically from California.
Yeah.
However, obviously, there's been a lot of discussion about, and you're correcting your observation that we look at our correction system as really functioning in two ways. One, it is to punish criminals for doing criminal acts. Mm-hmm. And the other side of it is to try to reform those individuals so that when they are returned to society, and they will be, that they do not then commit another act once they're out. And a lot of that has to do with what occurs with them while they're in the institution, and what we're finding more importantly is how we transition them out of those institutions and back into the community so that they are not provided the impetus to once again create additional
follow-up. Yeah, could you please get in touch with me after you've had an opportunity to look at this item and made some contacts, or just get more information and come and see me, and we can talk about it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Moore said I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I guess
I've got to move along at some point.
I will, but of the, this discussion of whether or not it's punitive versus rehab over time, we have moved away from rehab. Some for are providing tools inside of the institution in order to retrain individuals or to educate individuals because of budget constraints. And that change in policy in this state occurred some several years ago. I think if you would, and maybe we need to ask this question of corrections, what do they have inside of their institution actually that prepares individuals for coming out and staying out, and what kind of programs that exist inside. Through the budgetary process, we even grappled with last, I think it was last session, session before, of even keeping inside of those institutions basic management tools, you know, to keep from having riots. And so, you know, to suggest, I don't want to sit here and suggest to Senator Morissette that inside of those correctional institutions do we fund in the kinds of things that I think he's getting at that happens in California. And if I'm mistaken, let me know. But I hear some, see some shakings of heads. But we do basic stuff now inside the institution, except for requiring that a percentage of the that the inmates do some kind of work performance.
I'm sure Mr. Campbell will get to that in due course with the rest of his presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to quickly go over those items that you will find within the budget very quickly. Mm-hmm. One is the establishment of the Homeland Security Agency, and you will find that there will be a bill that's been drafted that is going through revision as we speak. What essentially Oregon is going to be unique in the way it approaches Homeland Security. Other states take one of two different forms. The first is they have a National Guard lead model where the National Guard, the adjutant general, is the one who is in charge of Homeland Security for the state, as is the case in Washington and Idaho. There are others where the Emergency Management Department is responsible for that that task. Oregon will be different in that under the operations we're currently doing through executive order, where we are placing all of those elements that are critical to a Homeland Security response under one roof. Those would include military, law enforcement, emergency management, fire response. We're hoping to include emergency medical response and, of course, liaisoning with agriculture, because all of those are potential areas. And what's unique about Oregon is all of those entities asked to be put together because they saw the close relationship they had. And so that will be what you will see as we continue down the road of Homeland Security. We also are asking to establish a methamphetamine unit within state police. As I'm sure all of you know, there is a growing epidemic around methamphetamine. This is a small item, but an important item, as we are seeing smaller mom-and-pop labs, as they've been referred to, are beginning to network, and as they network, it's critical for us to have the ability to do detective analysis of those efforts to essentially stop large-scale combined efforts rather than just single labs one at a time. Of course, the other
question, Senator Devlin.
Mr. Chair, I just noted on TV last night that they were talking about the state troopers and the dogs that were doing the I-5 corridor. And since the big stuff is coming up, I-5 corridor, and not the little, as I understand, the moms and pops, will this unit begin to focus in on what's coming from Canada, Mexico, and California through I-5?
Mr. Chair and Senator Winters, the answer is probably not, because they're focusing in two different areas. If you look at the meth problem as being really two major problems, one, of course, is the addiction to methamphetamine and the ready availability on the street of methamphetamine. That is an issue that we need to be working with our federal partners on and are doing so. It's a problem unto itself. The other side, and the one this is much more targeted to, is doing analysis of the in-home labs, which, although it produces a small amount of the overall on-the-street availability of methamphetamine, what that does do is it creates a very large stressor on most of our state resources in the area of law enforcement, child welfare, environmental cleanup, and things like that. So even though it's not the big part of the on-the-street addiction problem, it is a huge cost driver in and of itself, and so we're hoping to use this effort to deal with that. That does not mean we will be ignoring the other side.
Well, follow, is there, you said you will not be ignoring. Is there any plans in the future to make certain that the bigger piece, if you will also, you'll take some aggressive steps towards that, since you have state troopers that are actually patrolling and that are on I-5?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, of course those troopers that are on I-5 are always on the lookout for this issue, to the extent that we have resources to have those troopers on the highways. They're very cognizant of the need to be doing interdiction efforts. And again, we're currently working with the federal delegation and with our federal partners through the FBI and the federal attorney's office to make sure that we're being as aggressive as we can in dealing with that cross-the-border activity.
Senator Devlin. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you cut, I believe, 22 people from the Criminal Investigations Division of the State Department, and then launched an initiative on methamphetamine, I would like to know, actually not here today, but when we get into the Public Safety Committee, what capabilities we will lose within that division, because it's not as if that division existed without other responsibilities. I would assume we would maintain all the major crimes portions of that division in terms of many counties and many cities are dependent upon those units for assistance in those kinds of cases. So I'll be very interested in seeing how that whole department's going to be realigned with that reduction of a fifth of their staff.
So. We look forward to that also, Senator.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, we would be happy to have that discussion, because we really do need to have a very thorough discussion about that particular issue.
Yeah.
Of course, the next item is, because local law enforcement is so dependent upon our forensics efforts at the state level, we made a conscious effort to make sure that we had maintained all the forensics laboratories at their current level. If you move on to the next slide, we also have made an effort to continue the existing 850 close custody beds within the Oregon Youth Authority to establish a National Guard appreciation package, which combines both of those things that we found from discussions with our deployed troops, as well as issues that are being dealt with by their families, and, of course, just a desire on the part of the Oregon public to want to show their appreciation for the National Guard, a series of items. And we're very pleased to be working with a number of colleagues within the legislative process to bring about a package that all of us are working together on. So so that will be happening here in the very near future. Of course, a longstanding goal of ours has been to enhance the existing basic training for law enforcement from originally 8, then to 10, and then to 16 weeks. And Mr. McGee is going to be talking to you about that shortly. And then, of course, funding the Youth Challenge Program out of the Oregon Military Department, which has been a nationally recognized and successful program for those teens who are really on their last legs before going into the juvenile justice system, which has proven very effective. There are some things that, of course, are not going to be included in this budget, and I'm just going to highlight a couple of them very quickly. The first, of course, is the Oregon Youth Authority demand forecast beds. For the first time, we have changed the way that we forecast. Before, the forecast for juvenile beds was fairly easy. How many beds do you have? That is our forecast. What we have changed to is, what do we anticipate based on the growth of juvenile crime? If we were going to do a forecast similar to the way we do a forecast with adult corrections, what would that number be? And we could not afford to fund that level of beds, and so we decided to stay at the level we currently had with the Oregon Youth Authority. The other one, of course, is community corrections, which continues to be an issue between the state and local level, and I'll take a brief moment to identify what we plan on doing around that. If you had heard the governor make his comments about the budget around community corrections, we had provided some money to take into account a new forecast process, while at the same time reducing funds for a certain level of offenders who are currently being dealt with at the local level. And we said, basically, don't deal with that population anymore. This really goes back to a larger issue that has not been addressed adequately since 1995, when the community correction system came in place, and that is, does the local level feel that we as a state are really being good partners in the agreement that we forged with them. Those agreements are fairly old. They were based on assumptions that we didn't know whether they would pan out or not. And so what is our intention to do in the very short term is sit down with those local partners and say, look, if we want a community correction system that is going to work, what should that agreement look like? Because the difficulty is it's very difficult by looking at the problem to know whether the agreement is faulty or the funding is faulty. If we can deal with the agreement side so we know what that agreement should look like, then it should be a very clear question as to whether or not we have enough funds to address what those agreements say. And if they don't, we need to be upfront about that, and that will be what our next step will be in that area. But I wanted to give you a heads up on that, as I'm sure that's an issue you'll be hearing a great deal about as we move forward.
Question, Representative Vance.
Well, a comment. I'm glad that's the way you're embarking. That's incredibly important because definitely there's a feeling of lack of faith or bad faith by our county people towards the state government. And that can paralyze, that feeling can end up paralyzing a whole bunch of other relationships that of trying to get local government to work with us in different ways in order to move forward common agendas. And unless we have that, unless they have full faith in the state government to honor agreements and fully fund them, we're just at a dead end in terms of some pretty major government reform. So if we can rebuild that relationship with the counties, it would be incredible.
Just I would hope that the counties are also mindful of all the other things that we have done, especially in the last 2 to 4 years, and not cutting their budgets and not reducing their shared revenues, and that they would also recognize the fact that we did a pretty Herculean job in the interim to make sure community corrections were funded, and that that is respected. It's not respected, and that would be a bad omen for this coming legislative session. Also, I would hope that the governor's office has talked with them and has their buy-off that this spending $9 million here is better than spending $9 million in the community corrections program. Because there's no point in going down this road in the middle of a huge budget crisis with an $18 million hole in community corrections, and we put $9 million into figuring out, you know, a new way of doing things. And if the counties are okay with that, I'd like Representative Hansen excited about that new partnership that's going to develop on that basis. If that's not the basis, then we need to know real quick that they have to have a different allocation in that particular budget.
Mr. Chair, I would just urge you to communicate very closely and carefully with your county commissioner.
I don't see her that often. Representative Devlin first said. Senator Devlin said.
Mr. Co-Chairman, members of the panel there, and particularly the subcommittee chair on public safety, in light of this, trying to work better with cities and counties and sort of ALA former Representative Patridge. could you put the BPSST director on notice that I'll be asking a lot of questions about what the full cost will be of his training programs, including the debt service, and whether or not there should be a more appropriate sharing of the cost of those between state and local agencies?
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, I would be happy to make sure he is aware of that issue coming down the pike.
Okay.
Senator Morrison, Senator Morissette.
Just one observation, and maybe it was just an oversight, but in looking at the governor's priorities, what I don't see here is where is mental health in the scheme of all of this. For me and probably other members of the committee, when they come up, I'd like to have a listing of what programs do exist in the institution and if there is a waiting list and what those costly things are. That would be helpful when we get into our discussion in the subcommittee.
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters has expressed both through other principles within the governor's budget and the process they used of looking at mental health. And also, as you probably know, we just did a rather large interim public safety overview. One of the critical factors we found, especially at local government levels dealing with law enforcement, is without adequate mental health resources, those who are dealing with mental health issues are finding their way into the correction system rather than to the mental health system. and the correction system, especially at the jail level, has become a surrogate mental health system, and it's just not prepared for dealing with it.
Follow up. What degree of that exists in the bigger system, in OSP and Coffee Creek and some of those other systems? Because I know it exists in the jail system, but what also is existing in the correctional system? Because I didn't see it here, and so I just wondered at what the prevalence of it and whether or not the governor saw it as a priority issue.
Mr. Chairman, final.
Do you want to respond, Mr. Campbell?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, as was pointed out, that those programs were funded within the governor's budget. We realize that. Now, it's not a huge number of individuals within the Department of Corrections, but both for those who are in acute need of mental health services and those who need essentially maintenance programs to make sure they can remain stable, that's something that the Department of Corrections is looking very critical at, because if you have a population that merely requires medication to stay even, and you don't have the ability within the confines of the correction system to watch over and make sure that medication is being delivered and used, that can cause you security risks within that system. And I know that the Department of Corrections has been looking at ways to make sure that that doesn't become an additional problem. Part of that has been within the way we are currently funding the Department of Corrections, but we're always looking for better ways to take care of that particular problem.
Just to point out to Senator Winters and members of the committee, last time we were faced with much the same dilemma we are this time. Do we put money into rehabilitative programs, assistance to our prisoners, or do we fund the prison? And unfortunately, we're somewhat the same dilemma we have right now. Either we can keep people in prison, or we can fund the programs that will protect people when they get out of prison. That's a heck of a choice, and it's going to be very difficult. I look to the August chair to make the fine line adjustments here and trying to figure out how best to do that. Representative Richardson.
Mr. Co-Chair, adding to that mix is the cost of health services for those that are incarcerated. And there's a joke about the defense attorney who had a client who needed major surgery and was before the judge, and he's saying to the judge, "Your Honor, you have a duty to put this man in jail. He admits he committed the crime." But the prosecutor, understanding the cost of that surgery to the institution, is saying, "Your Honor, no, we really think probation would be appropriate. No, we want mercy." And so it's kind of a reverse fight because of the cost of medical care for those that are incarcerated. It's almost a planning model. If you need big surgery and you don't mind spending some time, it gets paid, but it's a huge expense.
Senator Morissette, please go right ahead.
Thank you. Just a reminder to the co-chair and other chairs of our committee that truly all government is local one way or another. And I think we need to talk with our county, our city officials, those people who deliver the services for the state. That's extremely important. Just a reminder.
Good reminder. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On a different subject, but something I'll be very interested in, and I think any information you could get to me will be helpful. On our the budget dilemmas we have in human services, I'm concerned in terms of impact on mental health programs and on health programs, on what the impact on drug courts and mental health courts will be, and because we need to be aware of all the consequences. So any information on the linkage of those specific programs would be helpful.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanson, we'll make sure we get that information specifically for you about those two programs.
Continue. Thank you.
Well, the good news is that now I get to hand it over to those who know the detail behind these budgets, and we'll now turn it over to Linda Gilbert.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Schrader, members of the committee. I'm Linda Gilbert with Department of Administrative Services Budget and Management. We are on slide number 8, and this shows the statewide budget in terms of principles. You've probably seen this slide 2 times already. This time we pull out the pieces that identify public safety, It is at 7% of total funds, but it consumes 14% of general and lottery funds. And I should note that these totals will not match totals that you will see on a later page, and that's because in the principal's budget, we excluded the funding for judicial, legislative, and miscellaneous funding. That was not part of building the principal's budget. Moving to the next page, what we will be looking at in the next few slides will be illustrations that define the budget drivers in public safety, some future trends, and also policy considerations that came out in the governor's budget. And this, we are now moving from the principal's budget to the program budget, which is the agency-by-agency budget, which is the way it will be presented to the subcommittee. So we begin on the 10th slide with what I affectionately refer to as the snake. This is the historical and forecast prison population. Mm-hmm. It is current as of the October 2004 forecast, and that's the one on which the governor's recommended budget is based. And the main point is that we don't see a leveling off for quite some time in the forecast. This goes out through 2014. And just to throw a few numbers at you, about a week ago, the population in the 12 institutions was 12,709. On July 1, we expect it to be 13,300, rising to 14,300 by the end of the biennium. In 2014, it looks like it's around 17,500. What that means on average in 05-07 is a net increase of about 40 inmates every month. The next slide is drills down a little bit deeper and illustrates the impact of ballot measure 11. And whereas I called the other slide the snake, this one I call the whale. There's a line dividing the historical portion of what that impact has been from the forecast portion. It's important to point out, and Darren Hill did a good job of this on Monday, that what you are seeing is not additional bodies, but additional bed days that are required as a result of the Measure 11 sentencing, of the mandated length sentencing. In the blue section, again, these are just additional bed days for people who would have been there anyway. These are criminals who have committed violent crimes. And so this is just the additional time that's needed to incarcerate them. The section below, the yellow section, is the number of bed days required for felons who might otherwise have gotten probation and not been in the system. And there's a heavy line up in the blue section that just compares the April 2000 forecast to the October 2000 forecast.
Senator Morris has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What would you estimate to be the cost per biennium for Measure 11, direct and indirect?
Chair Schrader, Senator Morris, I do not have that with me, but we will certainly make that available.
Senator Carter, then Senator Devlin.
Ms. Goldberg, can you please explain the distinction or the difference between numbers of bed days versus bodies?
Chair Schrader, Senator Carter, I will attempt to do that. If a sentence before Measure 11 was somewhat variable, then there would be that number of bed days. It might be 3 years, or it might be less than 3 years, or more than 3 years. With Measure 11, it is not variable. It's mandated, and it might be 4 years. So we need 365 times four, mm-hmm. that many beds, or that many days.
Follow up, Mr. How do you guys anticipate recidivism? How do you anticipate that versus new people in the system when you speak of the 40 days? Or is that a combination of both of those?
Chair Schrader, Senator Carter, fortunately, supporter.
You know, I'm sorry, because I forgot you, budget management, not corrections. I should have asked. This afternoon.
Thank you. I'm flattered. Fortunately, Sue Porter, who is with the DAS Office of Economic Analysis, is going to give a presentation on exactly how she comes up with the forecast and how she anticipates and folds back in recidivism, how she uses arrests rates, okay, conviction rates, and that sort of thing, and even addresses the aging population and will lay it all out.
Thank you.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I thought it would be important for the committee to be reminded, since this issue has come up about Measure 11, that if committee members are thinking that modifications to Measure 11 are major cost savings, in the long term, if you modified them, they might be major cost savings to the system. It does not include the cost to the public in terms of releasing those offenders. And also, though, in the short term, the cost savings are significantly less, because the crimes that are being committed are very major crimes. The parties are going to be incarcerated anyway. And unless you go back and resentence the people that have already been sentenced under Measure 11, your cost savings in this biennium are going to be minimal. So it's not a pot at the end of the rainbow of an easy way to solve a budget problem.
Mr. Co-Chair?
Representative.
I have a question for Ms. Gilbert or maybe Mr. McGee, and that is, do we have figures that compare the cost to incarcerate in Oregon with the cost in Idaho, California, and Nevada?
Chair Schrader, Representative Richardson, this is a question, and a very good question, that comes up frequently. It's a little difficult to get to exact comparison costs because different states require different programs, for instance, or different kinds of incarceration, different levels of incarceration. In fact, the cost per day will vary within Oregon from institution to institution to institution, whereas we would think it would be about the same, but it even depends on how the institution is designed, how many correctional officers you need to look around the corner or see straight down the hall. So attempts are made, and we continue to try to get that kind of information, and we'll continue to try to get that information, but I will just throw out the caveat that it is a little difficult to get right to apples and apples.
Then along with that difficulty, is there an analysis that's been taking place comparing the outcome base, they're incarcerated, so we have a goal there, and that's get them off the street. Then we also want them to be corrected, and one way you determine that is by measuring recidivism afterward. And so if there's a cost disparity and a recidivism disparity, then we could actually look at the programs involved and whether or not we're getting the maximum benefit for the dollars that are being spent. I'm wondering, is that analysis being done or has it been done?
Chair Schrader, Representative Richardson, yes. The Senate Bill 267 was passed last time,
right,
last session, that takes a hard look at evidence-based programming, and the Department of Corrections, Oregon Youth Authority, and others are pretty much continuously looking at their programs and looking at their outcomes, measuring recidivism, and doing that kind of studying. So there will certainly be more information about that as the session goes forward.
Okay, just one follow-up. And that's, who do we talk to actually get the connection between the benchmarks and the cost so that we can see how we compare with the other states as far as the figures, so that we can actually use that in determining funding that should take place?
Chair Schrader, Representative Richardson, I want to say that agencies will be presenting this to the subcommittees as we go through the process, and I believe there is also, isn't there a 267?
Well, if I can jump in, I mean, it's a very, very good question. The co-chairs have asked that exact same question, as has the chair of the committee, and it is difficult to get that information, but our LFO staff, working with BAM and others, is researching states around the country to get exactly that type of comparison. And I think that's absolutely critical. Actual dollars, recidivism rates, costs, those sorts of things. I understand it's different. I think Linda makes a great point.
but that is going to be critical to this committee making good decisions as we go down the pike. And I think if I'm a John Q. citizen out there, one of the questions that needs to be answered by the committee would be, why is Oregon consistently one of the highest spending prison state on prisons? Maybe there's a very good reason. You've alluded to how that might be the case. We're getting just excellent results, and there's some circumstantial evidence that seems to indicate we are getting better results than the other states. But I'm sure the committee will get into that because it's a very good point.
Yes, thank you.
Excuse me, Representative Krupp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions for you. Did you say prior in that we're adding about 40 inmates per day?
Chair Schrader, Representative Krupp, 40 per month.
Per month, okay. If, and Mr. Chair, if I may continue. So in that regard, if we have an expanding prison population, can you explain that to us when we have a crime rate that has, in essence, dropped steadily for some time now, or has it leveled out? Is it the crime rate increasing, so you're expecting that that's one of the drivers as to why we have 40 new people in the system every month?
Chair Schrader, Representative Krupp, this is one of those wonderful questions that I think Sue Porter is going to do a very good job of explaining when she shows how she does her forecast and what elements she takes in.
Very good. And second question, Mr. Chair, is, could you provide for this committee the number of known illegal aliens that are within the state correctional system, and any, and if you can give us a cost factor of those individuals and what they cost the state?
Sure, Schrader. Representative Krupp, yes, we can get that.
Well, it might be interesting, Linda, is on this very same graph, if you had on the same y-axis a
statewide expenditure
crime per capita graph that showed violent crime and all crime, and superimpose that over incarceration rate to try and get, I think, some of what the committee's grappling with.
Right.
Continue.
On the next slide, page 12, this depicts the Department of State Police governor's recommended sworn positions, and also shows the history of sworn positions since 1979-81. And I apologize that it is not an easy slide to read, but the story basically is that in 79-81, this was the last year that state police were funded by the highway fund, and they had a total of 937 sworn positions. There were 115 in fish and wildlife. Notably, there were 665 in patrol. The governor's recommended budget, the good news is that it holds patrol at the same level it was in 03-05. To some, the bad news is that that is 329 compared to the 665 they had in 79-81. It also funds 119 fish and wildlife officers. As we have already alluded to, there are 22 fewer detective positions in 03 than there were in 03-05. Six of those are as a result of Tobacco Task Force Part 2 shutting down. So it wasn't simply a matter of a general fund cut, but not all of that was a general fund choice. The others are mostly the part that's called other, mostly covers lottery and tribal casino gaming officers. And our next page.
Where are forensics in that? Are they in the criminal division, or are they in the 329 down below, or where do they fit into that?
Chair Schrader, they are, for the most part, professional positions, and they do not show up on this chart. The state police have professional positions and sworn positions, and the scientists are elsewhere.
Okay. Thank you.
And there are 107. And we go next to Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. You can have your toys up.
Good idea.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Bill McGee, Department of Administrative Services. The slide you're looking at now is a schematic of the new 250-acre campus that's being constructed for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training in the Salem area. And the point we want to make here simply is the budget for this agency is going to increase by about 73% to accommodate the debt service and the certificates of participation to build the facility, as well as the operation of the 24/7 campus and the expansion of the basic police training course from 10 weeks to 16 weeks.
You can present with us anytime you want, Mr. McGee. That was excellent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Question, Senator.
Yeah, this is not a question. It's just a comment, noting the phrase on the slide, which says training for excellence. It's important that we understand that even though we're moving from 10 to 16 weeks, we will still be far below the national standard in actual training hours. I believe that standard is 22 weeks. Mm-hmm. So we still have a ways to go. So let's be very clear about what we're saying when we're saying that we're training for excellence. We're training to a higher standard than we've had, but and we want what we do to be excellent, but we're still not close to where we need to be.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. Mr. McGee, at this point, you said that the campus is now under construction. Mm-hmm. Are all of the issues with the city at this point resolved?
Ms. Chair, Senator Johnson, I think there are some things still being negotiated. Primarily, everything's resolved. I think there's some utility issues that are being discussed in terms of the responsibility of the local utilities company to provide to the campus, but I think it's just sort of normal negotiations you have at this point in a project. I think everything is moving very successfully.
Thank you. Continue.
The final slides in this presentation take about five different views of the public safety budgets, beginning with a comparison how it lays out with the state. So within the program area, within all funds, public safety is 6%. However, within general and lottery funds, public safety jumps to 13%. And the reason is that it's more dependent on general fund is that it's less able to attract federal match or federal funding, and it's not reasonable in most cases to be charging fees for the services, so it needs general fund.
Linda, I assume that the judicial's in the other chunk of the pie there?
Judicial is in the other.
If you look at public safety judicial, the total amount would be close to 17% then?
That is correct. The next page is a depiction of funding history, and this shows program areas by percentage over time. And I believe Pam Keschner went over this with you yesterday. Beginning with the bottom bar, 1989-91, this is shown as a base because it was probably the last biennium when the legislature was fully in control of allocating all of the general fund before ballot measure 5 in 1990 and then ballot measure 11 in 94, which took away some of the discretion that the legislature had. So we would look at this as a base case. And public safety is shown here as 13%. The next bar up is 95-97, and public safety drops to 12% of the whole, but as you see, the state school fund is a good deal larger. And finally, in the 0507, 10 years later, in the 0507 recommended budget, the state school fund is again, or it's holding steady at about 42%. Public safety is larger, and you see that the squeeze then comes on higher ed, other education, and to some degree, human resources.
Can I ask a question?
Question, Senator Carter.
Linda, in this 13%, back on page 15, are lottery investigators include this 13%? The people who investigate lottery concerns?
Chair Schrader, Senator Carter, they are not. They're other funded.
Okay.
The next slide looks at the public safety program area compared to statewide by funding source. So statewide expenditures totaling $41.9 billion are 28% general and lottery funds. In the public safety program area, the expenditures are $2.4 billion, of which general fund and lottery fund are 66%. So there's a considerable difference there. And again, that reflects the ballot maker 11 driver, state police not being on the highway fund. Oregon Youth Authority is also heavily general fund dependent. The next slide is funding by budget category. And a couple of quick points here. The first is that in the bottom sections, this compares statewide on the left with public safety on the right, and we're looking only at general and lottery funds. The bottom section is personal services statewide. It is 21%. 21%. However, in public safety, personal services consumes a great deal more of the budget. It is very hands-on and requires a lot of people, a lot of state employees to manage it. And the other difference, debt service statewide,
wow,
it's 3%. However, in public safety, it's 9%. And about 85% of that is Department of Corrections certificates of participation debt service for construction. The final slide shows the 10 agencies within the public safety program area. And again, what it basically shows with all funds on the left, general fund and lottery funds on the right, is that the Department of Corrections consumes the greater share. And with that,
Senator Morissette has a question.
Going back to the lottery state police oversight, what about, you mentioned other funds. Do we have state police that are engaged in oversight of the Indian casinos?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
That's right.
Who funds
Indian
them?
Casino.
In other words, do we have a compact that the governor has some flexibility on in terms of asking them to fund the state? Do they fund the state police?
Chair Schrader, Senator Morissette, I'll have to find out.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, yes, the tribes, there is a negotiation with the tribes over the level of oversight, and the tribes do compensate the state police for their participation.
Senator Devlin has a question.
No,
she does. He does not. He's his usual comedic self. Representative Hannah.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you mentioned that it was more difficult to get the federal matching funds on the public safety side. Do you know what the match is, or approximately what the match would be?
Chair Schrader, Representative Hanna, it depends on what the program is. We are able to attract federal funding within Oregon Youth Authority for the youth who are not in close custody, for instance. So the match varies depending on what's being done. So I can't right now give you a specific amount, but that's certainly something that we'll be discussing when the Youth Authority comes before the subcommittee.
I'm going to have to follow up. I want to make sure, I'm a little new to this, but I'm trying to figure it in the math here. When you look at slide 15 and you look at the public safety portion of the general and lottery funds and then the all funds, you're gaining $970 million somewhere, so a 60-some percent match. I mean, is that fair to think about it that way? That from what you have on the public safety side being 13% of the general and lottery funds and the 6% of all funds, is that the federal match that's growing that number?
Chair Schrader, Representative Hanna, not exactly match. There are other federal funds at play here. For instance, Homeland Security attracts a lot of federal funding to, in turn, send out in grants to other local agencies, state agencies. There's also a large amount of federal FEMA money that comes through. And so that's not exactly a match for services, but it's something that comes up. So there are federal funds that do come in.
Co-Chair Schrader. Well, we may have the opportunity to dig further into this, but I want to understand that, so this might not be the appropriate time, but I'd like to understand how the match works and what part of the federal part isn't match.
It's a good subcommittee discussion.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Gordley.
So are we at the end of the presentation?
I'm sure we are, because Devlin didn't really want to answer questions.
I do have a question. I think it would help the full committee and the subcommittee to understand the governor's approach to dealing with the judicial department and that area of the budget, which is also in the public safety committee. Could you talk about that briefly?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gurley, I will try. My understanding is because the judicial budget falls under independently... we have somebody who can answer that question.
You're doing great. Mr. Chair and Senator Gordley, Kelly Friels with the Department of Administrative Services Budget Management, obviously. Because the judicial branch is a separate branch of government, the governor has no control over that budget. And so typically what we do, just like the legislative branch, is do not make any recommendations on the budget. We simply put a benchmark budget together that reflects what the average reduction this time around was for all other agencies. And so we reduced them by 9% like we did the legislative branch as a placeholder, not making any recommendations on the programs that might solicit.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
And just to plant a seed, the subcommittee open to their discussions, but I think it is indeed a separate branch of government. I think for illustrative purposes, we're looking at chunks of the pie. I think it makes sense to have a public safety slash judicial type of chunk, because it looks strange in the other. It looks like the other sometimes gets called administration and confused with natural resources. So if the subcommittee is interested in that, I think that way we could have a better picture next session as we come into this. Senator Devlin's been very patient. Yes, sir?
Yes. I just wanted to clarify something so that the committee understands that almost in every case where we have a specialized function for the state police, the underlying entity that is creating that specialized function is paying for the cost, even some of them very creatively. And, for instance, we've moved some Measure 66 funds into game enforcement. We actually moved some motor carrier funds into vehicle inspections in the last session. We have literally used every creative means we could find to fund the state police. While in an exception to the gaming portion, while it's not lottery dollars as we consider lottery dollars, because we consider them, I believe I'm right, we consider them lottery dollars if they're coming through us, through the allocation from the Lottery Commission. The Lottery Commission is paying for them, so their ultimate source is lottery dollars. They just show up as other funds because they don't go that route.
Very good. Well, we've got an hour to do every other budget in the entire state
of the universe.
Senator Morris, comment.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I don't want to make this a discussion point, but I would just like to point out that there are considerable discrepancies in the numbers that we have been given. And it would be helpful to have numbers that are consistent. I would just point that out.
Good comment. We want to chew them up, particularly during something. All right. Next group of exciting presenters. Going to dazzle us for the next hour.
Surely you don't mean Mr. Carrier.
No, they just gave us
a joke. You better dive right in or the natives will get restless.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning. For the record, my name is Mike Carrier. Assisting me today is Lisa Pearson and Cora Parker from the Department of Administrative Services Budget Management. I learned yesterday that my title as Governor's Natural Resource Advisor has now been changed to Governor's Other Advisor, and I'm here today to present to you the all other portion of the Governor's recommended budget and to point out to you that that does not include the judicial budget. It's just the other agencies except judicial.
That doesn't give you a sense of importance.
Most of you know me as the Governor's Natural Resources Policy Director. You can imagine my surprise when I learned yesterday that I was going to make this presentation. It reminds me of the story that Abraham Lincoln told one time about the young boy that walked into the blacksmith shop and the smithy had just laid this red-hot horseshoe on the anvil. And he saw the boy spying that horseshoe, and he said, "Son, I wouldn't touch that if I were you." The boy ignored him. He picked up the horseshoe and immediately put it back down. And the blacksmith said, "It was hot, wasn't it?" And the young boy said, with as much bravado as he could muster, "No, it just doesn't take me long to look at a horseshoe." Unlike the young boy in that story, Mr. Chair, I've spent about as much time as he did looking at that horseshoe, looking at this presentation. And I will, though, try to muster the same amount of bravado that he did. I do know you as a charitable group of people, so I will, as I move through this, please understand that some of these areas are areas that I normally do not advise the governor on. Throughout the session, you will be afforded many opportunities to explore these budgets and details in the Ways and Means subcommittees with many capable people who you know, people like Marty Brantley, Bruce Warner, Corey Stretchinger, and Lori Warner. We're going to go to the slides, if we could go through, let's see, yes, that slide there. I'm going to first talk about economic development, and let's move on from slides 3 and 4. We'll talk about the governor's budget principles here. There are three that we're going to discuss in the all other budgets, and they're shown on these slides. We'll stop at slide 5 on economic development. And the governor's principle for economic development is that Oregon has a positive business climate and invests in economic development in order to create and retain sustainable businesses and family wage jobs. Now, for Oregon to compete in a national and global economy, the governor firmly believes that we have to make strategic investments in building Oregon's capacity to innovate. That means refocusing on recruiting, expanding, and retaining businesses that create sustainable new jobs through innovation of new products and services, through enhancing startup capital and infrastructure that promotes commercialization of research into new and existing companies. The governor's recommended budget provides development and operating funds for Oregon's first signature research center, the Oregon Nanoscience and Microtechnologies Institute, and a pre-seed or proof-of-concept fund for commercializing research into business ventures. His budget also creates a commercialized research fund that would be available to businesses with fewer than 100 employees that want to work with Oregon's research institutions to develop new products or refine existing products. The governor's budget also continues his effort to increase the availability of project-ready industrial sites in Oregon, something we've been working very hard and very aggressively on the last couple of years. In recruiting new companies to Oregon, we find that we're competing against states where a company can pick from numerous 25-acre or larger industrial sites and get the necessary permits very quickly. We need to level the playing field on that, and the governor's budget seeks to do so. The governor's recommended budget further continues Oregon's investment in transportation through its Connect Oregon program. This is an initiative to improve Oregon's multimodal transportation infrastructure. In addition, the budget invests in regional rural projects that will advance state priorities to create jobs in rural areas around the state. Now, some of the specifics in the economic development budget that I'd like to point out to you include the following four. The governor's $2 million investment in the Commercialized Research Fund will provide a significant return on our investment to help Oregon researchers turn innovative ideas into business ventures by helping approximately 15 small businesses or university spinoff companies to commercialize their new products, and by leveraging an estimated $15 of private sector investment for every $1 of public investment. Secondly, the $60 million in lottery bonds for developing industrial lines that will be available through this budget are estimated to create 1,440 construction jobs, 31,392 permanent jobs, and provide 3,600 usable industrial acres, generate $972 million in local property tax revenues, and generate $1.6 million in state income tax revenues. And finally, it will facilitate the development of 23 industrial sites and 3 large opportunity sites and 20 certified sites within those 23. The third thing this budget will do for economic development is that it provides $3.5 million for the Regional Rural Investment Fund, which will assist economic development across Oregon and is expected to create over 4,600 new jobs in Oregon and leverage $225 million in federal and other funds for economic development in rural communities. And finally, the Connect Oregon...
Mr. Carrier, question from Senator Morissette.
That's very interesting. I don't see that information before us.
Mm-hmm.
Could you get that for us, the details of what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, absolutely. And in fact,
very important and very interesting, and I want to have a complete packet of what you're talking about.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, yes, we will provide that to you.
To the committee.
And finally, in the Connect Oregon program, using $100 million in lottery bond proceeds, this program will allow Oregon Transportation Commission to leverage funds with public and private companies to strengthen Oregon's rail connections, its marine commerce, aviation, and transit facilities. It invests in other modes of transportation to provide critical links for shippers to connect to national and international markets, speed delivery times, and create jobs. It'll invest in our rail and marine transportation systems to preserve highway infrastructure investment because those systems reduce travel and heavy loads on our highways. And finally, it will support jobs in transportation infrastructure and traded sector industries that pay competitive salaries and promotes additional growth. Let's go to slide six.
Question.
Thank you. Before you go further, we passed Senate Bill 1128 two or three sessions back that gave direction to the department to increase resources for women and minority-owned businesses. And everything that you've said thus far, I've heard no mention of what our efforts will be in that arena. And as you're providing your report to the committee, I would like to see some specific information that says what our investment will be in growing businesses in that sector. And I mentioned women, particularly fastest-growing business sector, one of the fastest-growing business sectors. Hispanic-owned businesses, again, the fastest-growing business sector in the state. But in these presentations that we get from Department of Economic and Community Development, there's most often not a mention of that sector unless someone brings it up.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I'd like to respond to that, and I will talk just specifically about the Oregon Transportation Investment Act, the OTIA, and what's in the governor's budget, and then I'll ask Cora. I think she may be able to offer some additional information with regard to economic development's budget. But within the OTIA, since the passage of it, the governor has worked to ensure that as we rebuild Oregon's transportation infrastructure, that we help Oregon's minority and women-owned businesses.
That one I'm familiar with, Mr. Chair, if I can say that they have a very aggressive effort going forward in the Department of Transportation, which frankly needs to be modeled by some of our other state agencies. So again, my comment is about the Economic and Community Development Department and needing to better understand what's going on there.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I'm going to ask Cora because she can speak to that with regard to economic development.
Thank you. Thank you. For the record, Cora Parker from the Budget and Management Division, Department of Administrative Services. Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, with respect to the governor's recommended budget, that there is continued investment in both the focus on small businesses and in women and minority-owned businesses within the department. What Mike was discussing with you today were some of the large investments, some very significant dollar amounts that were invested in addition to continuing program levels. And at the subcommittee level, we will ask Economic Development, the department, to address the details of what they're doing in the area that you're focusing on.
Yeah, again, I'm going to make the point that we keep marginalizing the efforts that are going forward in the other categories, and we need to stop doing that.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Comment.
Last sessions, Senator Dukes Senator George and several of us addressed this issue in terms of a larger policy, Mr. Carrier, not in the just in the Department of Transportation and not just the Department of Economic Development where there are known opportunities. But when we look even in the area of procurement, we don't see that. And if I can just piggyback on Senator Gordley, because it would appear to me that what she is saying is not just in a particular area. What is the policy of this state? And why is that not an inclusive act of discussion in the broader policies along those lines? Two things that we know in this state from the time when I chaired the committee on, co-chaired the Committee on Trade and Economic Development, is that if we are going to get more people engaged in the revenue sharing activity of this state, then we have to invest in those arenas. And those arenas in particular is that women-owned businesses tend to hire more women who basically are maybe even women who want to work part-time, women who've not been in the workforce in a long time but want to get back into the workforce. I know in North Northeast Portland we have three generations, Mr. Chairman and members of this committee, of unemployed, long-term unemployed people. And then when you look at the justice, don't get me on my pedal today because I'm telling you I get upset about it. When you look at the Justice Department and then we have the Corrections Department and we're talking about the disproportionality issues of minorities in that force, it would appear to me that we are most negligible, if you will, in terms of trying to do something about this issue. It costs this state more money to put a person in prison than it would to send them to Harvard University. So why aren't we investing money on the economic development end to try to retrain these people to get into the workforce or to be revenue sharers? Quite frankly, I'm retired and I want my damn money. So if you keep them off the rolls, kick them off welfare, they're nothing but a burden on the state. So why aren't we doing something about that? So if all of you smart folk in this body want to talk about revenue sharing, how we don't talk about taxes more, how we kick people off welfare, then by George, do something about it economically. And that's what we're not doing. So we want to see the larger policies from the governor on down reflecting what we do for women and minorities and trying to help them get back into the revenue sharing of this state.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carter, Senator, once again, you've absolutely inspired me, and based on the success that we're seeing in the OTIA program and the comments of Senator Gordley about pushing that success into other areas, and your comments today, this is a policy discussion that we will carry back into the governor's policy circles. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Senator Winters.
I can't add any more to what the other two senators said, but I would ask that when you come back with information before the subcommittees, the more detail, that you give a comparison analysis as to where we were, let's say, 10 years ago, and where we are today, and that include more than the OTA, because economic development, that department has existed before just now, and also with the agency that is responsible for looking at opportunities for minority and women, that they should have a longitudinal graph of some sort to say what we have done in this state with respect to contracts and how many dollars actually have been given, if you will, through them. And I think that's something that the committee would like to receive. And
good comment. Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to talk now about the principle regarding livability in the environment, and the principle is that Oregon has a healthy balance between growth, infrastructure development, and environmental protection. In order for Oregon's environment and its economic health to both coexist and coexist healthily, we must recognize they are inextricably linked. We need to enhance and protect our natural resources while also contributing to Oregon's economic growth through responsible infrastructure development. The governor's 2005-2007 budget pursues the balance between growth, infrastructure development, and environmental protection by redirecting general fund expenditures and leveraging other funds so as to preserve or enhance key functions essential to the livability of our state's environment and the growth of our economy. This budget enables natural resource agencies to carry out their key functions related to things like salmon recovery, watershed health,
protection from wildfires, and meeting our obligations to protect and improve water quality in our streams. The budget also makes a commitment to address water rights claims in the Klamath Basin, a highly volatile issue and one that needs to be resolved because of its complexity and the impact that it has on the economy down there. It also provides funding to begin a top-to-bottom review and modernization of Oregon's land use planning system. It addresses key water quality issues on the Willamette River. The recommended budget also seeks to aggressively reduce the backlog that we've accumulated in water quality permits in our Environmental Quality Agency. We've made great progress on that, reducing the backlog from 60% to 30% of the permits. We want to get to 10% by the end of the next biennium. In keeping with the governor's goal of a new park a year, this budget also directs an increased amount of the dedicated lottery dollars for parks to repairing existing parks, acquiring and developing new parks, and assisting local governments with their park projects. Now, some of the things that we expect to get out of this governor's budget as we invest it, it purchases enhanced protection of Oregon's water quality for drinking, recreation, and fish restoration, to things like the establishment of additional standards for pollutants of our surface waters, by strengthening the enforcement of water quality standards in the Willamette River, and working in partnership with business and civic organizations in keeping the Willamette clean, and investing approximately $40 million, again, into the restoration of the health and function of our watershed and recovery of salmon, an issue that in the current biennium we weren't able to fully do because of fund shifts that had occurred. Other things that we're doing with this budget, as I said, is reducing that backlog of water quality permits with a goal of getting it down to 10% by the end of the biennium, and working aggressively on the continued recovery of salmon and other native fish species with the potential, we hope, in the next biennium for coastal coho to be delisted as a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act. This budget also purchases growth of sustainable economic development. It improves the response rate and issuance for water quality permits. It enhances the productivity of our state-owned and private forest lands through technical assistance that we provide. It works aggressively, as I said, to recover fish and engage in other conservation activities that include hatchery reform, research, harvest management, to ensure sustainable populations of fish for future generations. It also makes investment in our quality of life by creating, as I said earlier, a new park a year, and protecting Oregon's through enhancement of our food safety program and increasing the net revenue from the state common school and lands. It will increase the number of wetland mitigation banks to facilitate economic development, and it will, as I said earlier, adjudicate the Klamath Basin water rights issues.
Quick question.
Question, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. You talked about the economic development efforts. Share with me, how do you go about making sure that small business owners throughout the state know about the opportunities available to them to participate in contracts or to submit applications for grant funding?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, if I could ask for clarification, is that question with regard to economic development grants or with regard to, say, grants that natural resource agencies may
have? I truly apologize. What I was referring to was, I'll hold my question. I apologize. I thought I heard you referring to stream restoration projects is what I thought I heard you saying. I apologize.
Well, Senator Schrader, Representative Smith, I would like to extend on that because one of the things that we are most proud of is the opportunity to provide significant numbers of dollars in natural resources for grants for groups like watershed councils and local units of government to engage in conservation activities that do have the dual benefit of natural resource conservation and bolstering local economic development, things like park grants or grants for watershed enhancement or even fish restoration projects. On the economic development side, I frankly don't have the expertise to answer just how the department does its outreach and how it makes funds available. Now, earlier in my presentation, I talked about the amount of money being available for small businesses of under 100 employees that wanted to start up to take advantage of new and emerging technologies, and perhaps that's the part of the presentation that caught your attention.
Just one quick comment. Thank you. When you're doing those type of efforts, are you connecting with Oregon's Small Business Development Center networks and in partnering, because they're really the front door for helping small businesses in the state of Oregon?
Senator Schrader, Representative Smith, I don't know the answer to that question, but I will assure that it gets transmitted and the message implied in that question gets transmitted to the department.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you. And just a statement, because this would be something that should be taken up by the committee, but also to make sure that, particularly with OECDD, that the grants and the programs are accountable and responsible. Too often in that agency, I've seen programs that have no accountability at the end. Money is given to a business. I'm aware of one instance, $100,000, with a business plan that couldn't pass muster in a bank, and there was no mechanism to recoup the $100,000 when the business plan ultimately failed. I know this is outside of Mr. Carrier's issue area, but I hope that the committee has the opportunity to explore just how responsibly the agency is making grants. And I don't dispute that they should be available, but we're investing public money. It should be at a no less standard than a commercial lending institution.
Or perhaps higher.
Question, Representative Hanna.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I just wonder, when we talk about a sure core natural resource management, could you relate to us how that might have affected, or a trend, how that's affecting natural resource-based jobs? I mean, what are we doing to promote those? We're talking about, you know, take care of the backlog for water quality permits and salmon restoration, but how might it have affected job growth or loss in the natural resource harvest industry?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, I would like, as part of that answer, to talk about the water quality permit backlog, despite your caution that you didn't need to hear it. But that is a very important one, because the opportunity for industries to expand or even start up that require wastewater discharge permits is dependent on getting that permit. And when there's that huge backlog, there's a lag time, and often they lose the opportunity to start up and or invest and create those jobs. With regard to the other natural resource-based industries, like forestry, for example, a failure to invest and appropriate and adequate fire control certainly results in a diminishment of the resource base, which reduces the amount of fiber available for the mills and jobs. I'm not saying that has happened, but that is a potential consequence of failure to adequately invest in a critical natural resource. Certainly, the listings of a number of salmon in the Northwest, and particularly Oregon, has had an impact on the sport fishing industry, on the commercial fishing industry, and will continue to do so. And that's why it's a goal of the governor's, is to work with the federal agencies in an aggressive recovery strategy that recovers and delists those fish sooner rather than later, so that we don't have those kinds of economic impacts and job losses.
Very good. Continue.
We're at slide 7 now, and I'm going to talk to you about the last group of agencies, which is the group that we're going to refer to under the principle of government efficiency and accountability. And that principle of state government is stable, responsive, and accountable to Oregonians. State government must be a responsible steward of the public's money. This means we must work in a cooperative and coordinated manner with our partners in the private sector, with local government, counties, cities, and special districts. We serve the same constituency across government, and we know that it's our mutual goal to provide them with superior customer service. Now, the governor's made improving governmental accountability and service a priority of his administration. His goal has been to rebuild the trust of Oregonians in their state government and to ensure the state agencies uphold their commitment to use taxpayer dollars to enhance the quality of life for all of us. This means a commitment to continuous review and improvement, and it means making government communications and actions transparent, understandable, and accessible. The governor's recommended budget includes several items that specifically focus on stability and accountability by establishing, first, a rainy day fund by 2009, a plan for a rainy day fund by 2009, the consolidation of data centers from the 12 largest state agencies, which will save money, provide better security, and set the stage for future efficiencies. It examines ways to reduce health care costs for state employees. It continues the implementation of an internal audit program for state agencies. And it provides for the final implementation of PERS reforms and stabilizing the public retirement program. The governor's budget, some of the specific things that we're talking about in the budget under stability, and in the event the stability fund, in the event that the economy does not meet the growth projections, as well as the ability to lessen the impact on other priority services if public demands and additional services through judicial or initiative systems, the stability fund will help offset those additional demands. It will provide millions of dollars in savings and economies of scale through shared services, through implementation of audit recommendations that arise from things like internal audits, and the sharing of best practices throughout state government with its partners. The budget also provides that health care coverage for the needs of state employees will be taken care of, but at a lower inflationary rates than currently projected for the future. And it provides, finally, for a fair retirement program for public employees at a fair price to their employers, the taxpayers. Now, if we could go to slide 8. Just want to review with you the governor's priorities under the all other budgets. His economic development principle, which we're seeking to make strategic investments in building Oregon's capacity to innovate, focusing on recruiting, expanding, and retaining businesses that create sustainable new family wage jobs. Under the livability principle, we're seeking to ensure that Oregon fulfills its responsibilities under federal laws regarding the environment. We can go on. And funding programs that leverage significant federal dollars and other funds. And we are limiting fund shifts that occurred in the current biennium to return agencies to their core natural resource and conservation functions, limiting to the extent possible. As you will see in this budget, some fund shifts of things like Pacific Coast Salmon Recovery money and even some Measure 66 money. And finally, under the accountability principle, I just wanted to review that we're seeking to rebuild the public's trust in their state government and to ensure state agencies uphold their commitment to use state taxpayer dollars to enhance the quality of life for all Oregonians. Next slide. This slide shows you, for all funds for the other agencies, what the total budget is by principle, and then the breakout of general fund and lottery funds. Next slide. And we're going to go to Cora Parker, unless there are questions for me. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Question, Senator Morris.
Mr. Chairman, I just need to register this concern. The consistency of numbers needs to be present. And the continual reference to general fund and lottery funds has $11.231 billion is confusing. And those that are not present and listening, when they see and look at these published documents, they get incorrect information. So I would suggest that there be some degree of consistency in how these things are presented. I think it would be very helpful in talking about accountability so that the public can understand exactly what we're doing. If they were to look at these numbers and not having been present, they wouldn't understand them. And so I just offer that as a suggestion to help the public understand what's happening here.
Well, certainly in our own house, we'll have to be very, very careful about that.
Thank you. And Mr. Chair, Senator Morse, I think we've heard your message loud and clear. I think when you see these sort of slides again, we'll at the very least have a footnote on them when you're looking at a principles display versus a statewide display that includes the legislative branch and judicial, something that makes it clear that that's what the discrepancy in the numbers is, that actually the 11.2 doesn't include those two units. You're right. If you've got people who are coming in and out of the room or someone just picking this document up, that is not obvious, and we'll take that into account.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is, again, Cora Parker from the Budget and Management Division within the Department of Administrative Services. We have 5 program areas that fall within the 3 principles that Mike just spoke to you about. The 5 program areas are economic development, natural resources, transportation, administration, and consumer and business services. And within those 5 program areas, you have about 50, give or take, agencies that comprise those areas. So you're going to get a very high-level overview today of the agencies and, frankly, even of the program areas that make up the all other category. And again, as we get into the subcommittees, you'll get down into that more detailed level. Moving to the next slide. I'm going to just go through really quickly through these slides because really Mike addressed most of these areas. As far as the significant issues go, you've seen a number of population drivers in the other categories. You've seen caseloads, et cetera. All others really a very different group. I think it's there are some of those drivers, but not to the same extent and the same obvious level that Human Services, State School Fund, and the Public Safety area have. In the economic development area, again, the significant issues have been creating and retaining sustainable businesses, and there are a number of different ways that the governor's budget proposes to do that. The natural resources program area, again, we talked about a comprehensive review of the land use planning system, greater emphasis on protecting and restoring water quality. And then next slide, within the administration area, there are a number of items that we're doing to restore the public's trust and to basically move towards greater efficiencies. Most of you have probably heard of the Scenic project, the Consolidated Data Center project, where we're moving 12 of the state's largest data centers together. We're also continuing implementation of internal audit programs and obviously continuing implementation of the PERS reform that this body passed in the last legislative session. The transportation area, we're continuing to invest in a number of areas, including transportation infrastructure with respect to freight mobility, but we're also focusing on some non-highway issues. And we are, as discussed earlier, talking about moving delivery activities not only within the state itself, but to partner with the private sector as well. Within the consumer and business services area.
Question, excuse me. Representative,
you're going fast, and that's good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Back on page 13, the data center consolidation, can you briefly tell us, is that been approved? Are we going to be looking at money for that, requests for that? Can you just give us a couple more sentences quickly like you're doing?
Sure. Mr. Chair and Representative Wisnett, the concept, the initial phases for the data center consolidation project have been approved by the emergency board during the interim. The building has started under construction as we speak, and the implementation plan to consolidate those 12 agencies is underway. There will be additional one-time investments that is included in the governor's recommended budget and will need to be reviewed and hopefully approved by this body. And following those one-time investments in this biennium, the ongoing operational costs are anticipated to significantly decrease over the next several bienniums.
When we see those, Mr. Chair,
please follow.
When we see those, Chair, that request, will you show us what we've saved, or how we've spent our money, and let be able to?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, it's important to understand that within the context of the current biennium, the one-time investments will outweigh the savings that we see on the operational side, but the business plan and the implementation plan will show the timeline for when those things come to sort of an equivalent basis and then start to provide savings ongoing.
And, of course, we'll monitor to see if we actually get those savings.
Absolutely. Good. Yes. And I can slow down if you want me to. I'm assuming that you're...
DMV computer systems come to mind, Mr. Chair. So, yeah, I would hope... My apologies for speaking out of turn, sir, but I just... I am very suspicious. Now, we spend somewhere around $1.5 to $1.7 billion in a two-year all-funds budget on computers, software, consultants, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And yet we don't really know what the total number is. Okay. And it seems to me that there's a lot of opportunity there for things to happen that people are not really watching closely. And I want to make sure that this program really works here. So you can expect that several of us are going to be following this very, very closely.
Sure. And Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Krupp, I'm actually one of those people who wants to watch it very closely for some of the reasons that you mentioned. And the goal of the program is that by consolidating and having this huge investment in under one area rather than in disparate areas across the agencies, that you will have more control over it. Instead of just being buried within individual agency budgets, you'll be able to see what the individual, what the direct investments are that we're making, at least in the data center and networking area. And as we've talked, there are potential other areas to focus on, but those are sort of down the road at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Fair comments. Continue.
Okay. I'm going to go ahead and move to slide 16. And this, again, is a slide that you've seen before. And as Senator Morse would point out, this is the slide that popped back to the 11.9 million dollars on the general fund and lottery fund side. This, again, from a total perspective, includes both the legislative branch and the judicial branch. With respect to the all other category, you can see that it makes up about 43% of your all funds budget. However, of the general fund and lottery fund budget, it makes up just 11%. Moving to the next slide, this again is one that you've seen before for the other program areas. Special payments on a statewide basis and the breakout between the other categories. Basically, the all other programs follows pretty much the statewide perspective with respect to that split. Moving to the next slide. This is now talking just the general fund and lottery fund split. And you'll see at a statewide level, special payments makes up a huge proportion, or at least the most significant proportion, of the general fund lottery fund category. That's because you see state school fund, for example, which is entirely a special payment out to school districts. The general fund and lottery fund that's contained in all other budgets, first of all, is a very, very small percentage of those agencies' budgets. But what it does fund is primarily either debt service for lottery bonds or its direct personal services state staff members working on specific programs. So there's a disparity there between how the breakout between special payments, personal services, et cetera, shows statewide versus how it shows in these categories. If you move to the next slide.
What are some of the examples, Cara, of the special payments in the all other budget?
Special payments in the all other budget would include, for example, ONAMI, the $7 million in economic development that will be transferred to that program for the Signature Research Centers. We've got regional rural, again, for economic development. Those funds go out primarily as special payments. It's really limited in the special payments category. For the most part,
cities and counties transportation dollars.
Absolutely. Some of those. With respect to transportation, however, a lot of those contracts actually show up within the services and supplies category. They're actually professional services contracts rather than special payments. So that actually helps to make up some of the difference between why you see that disparity between statewide in this category.
Thank you.
Moving on to economic development, again, this is, you've got housing, state fair, employment, the Economic Development Department itself, and then the Department of Veterans Affairs. Their all funds budget is just a shade over $5.3 million. Their general fund and lottery funds budget is very small compared to some of the programs you've heard about. It's just under $140 million. Focusing again on that general fund and lottery fund side, OECDD makes up the largest component there, and their general fund and lottery funds are primarily to fund staff operations within their department, debt service, lottery funds to pay for debt service on lottery bonds, and then pass-through dollars that we just talked about to ONAMI, regional, rural, et cetera. With respect to the remaining remaining agencies in the program area, you can see that there are very small portions of general fund and lottery fund in those area. General fund funds vet services in the Department of Veteran Services. Within the employment division, it funds child care programs. And then within state fair and housing, it funds both lottery funds for debt service and then operations for the state fair, and some funding for homeless assistance in the housing department. And Lisa will talk about the natural resources area.
Mr. Chair, my name is Lisa Pearson of the Department of Administrative Services, and I will be talking about this slide showing the all funds resources for the natural resources program, as well as the general fund and lottery funds. The first thing to note is that especially if you look at the all funds on the left-hand side, there are two agencies in this pie chart that are showing up as 0%. That is simply because of rounding, and they really
do
have
more agencies to show up as 0%.
We tried many ways of displaying things so that this wouldn't show up this way, but nothing worked very well. Obviously, they do have money in their budgets, but they're so small in comparison to the overall budget for this program area that they were less than 1%, and so they rounded to zero. The same thing is true over on the general fund and lottery fund side. State lands has a little bit of general fund in it, but it's so small that it's not showing up on this graph as having any. On the other hand, Marine Board does not have any general fund in it at all. So that is a complexity to this graph. You can see that there are 14 different agencies, and there is no single agency in this program area like in other program areas that dominates. On the general fund and lottery fund side, about $140 million of the general fund lottery fund total is, in fact, Major 66 dedicated lottery funds. There's $34,000 in this program area of non-dedicated, non-Major 66 lottery funds. Those are in agriculture for county fairs. That also helps explain why the Parks and Recreation Department is showing up at 29%, and that is because of the Parks and Natural Resources funding for Major 66, which is dedicated. There is no longer any general fund in Parks and Recreation Department itself. It has all moved over to lottery funds. And that is really a quick summary of the whole program area. Obviously, there's a lot of detail that will need to be discussed in the actual subcommittee hearings. But there's so much in going on here, and there are so many agencies that are about the same size that culling out a significant issue and highlighting that just didn't prove to be fruitful.
Mr. Chair. Question, Representative Kropp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question for you. On the general fund side of that slide, Watershed Enhancement Board at 17%, Parks and Rec at 29%, they both receive equal amounts from Measure 66 funds. The differences are in the fees that Parks... No, what are the differences then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krupp, what this slide is showing is the actual lottery funds, Major 66, that OWEB retains for its own use. There is another portion that goes out to ODFW and to... agriculture and other agencies. And so you're right, the initial allocation from the lottery is equal to OWEB and to Parks and Recreation, but OWEB then sends money out to other agencies, and this shows what ultimately the spending pattern would look like.
Thank you.
This is an area that consumed a lot of time for the subcommittee last session in trying to put it together. I think they were very successful because neither the environmentalists nor the natural resource lobby were appreciative of the work they did. But it did create some difficulties, but that subcommittee action, again, I thought really pulled it together and did a fairly good job of trying to balance the disparate interests in the state of Oregon. So I'll have another challenge this session, I think, to do the same thing.
And moving on, Cora will take you through the remainder of the slides.
Thank you. Looking at the transportation program area, this just includes two agencies, the Department of Aviation and the Department of Transportation. Excuse me. With respect to the all funds budget, the Department of Transportation makes up obviously the largest portion there, with aviation just a very minor piece of that budget. Department of Transportation includes highway funds, program operations, OTA investments there, etc. On the general fund and lottery fund side, the $42 million is comprised of $33 million in lottery funds, which is debt service on outstanding Department of Transportation lottery bonds. Actually, that's outstanding and some proposed lottery bonds. And then $9 million of general fund related to the train. Moving to the administration program area, again, a number of agencies here. I think the largest agency with respect to the all fund side is the Public Employees Retirement System. With respect to that side, that includes employer contributions and employee contributions for that matter, and then benefits that are being paid out to retired employees. So significant, but it's a non-limited budget. It is not operational funds per se. On the general fund and the lottery fund side, the Department of Revenue makes up the largest portion there. They are almost entirely funded on the operational side with general fund. some small amounts of general fund and lottery funds in the other agencies, but not significant parts of operational programs. Moving to the Consumer and Business Services program area, again, the all funds budget, $840.1 million, and you see a number of agencies in this area, mostly small boards and commissions. On the general fund and lottery fund side, just one agency has general fund, and that's for operational programs related to the Bureau of Labor and Industries. The rest of those programs are entirely comprised of other funds. There may be some small amounts of federal funds. I think it's mostly other funds in those agencies. So that, again, is a very high-level overview of some of the funding sources for the 50-some agencies that you'll see, again, at the detail level in subcommittees. And I think we're happy to answer any questions that you have at this time.
Questions by any of the committee members? Representative Crum?
On that last slide, number 23, Boley receives all of the $11.6 million. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And that's general fund, again, and lottery. Okay, thank you.
Just a comment. I would hope that the committee would not spend an inordinate amount of time on these small other fund agencies, or actually not agencies, the boards and commissions. Certainly if there is a problem, you know, that needs to be addressed, and time to time there's some legal issues that these various boards are dealing with. Sometimes there's kingdom building by a well-meaning administrator that needs to be addressed. But this session, we have such Herculean tasks to deal with our big issues that I would hope that unless there's a major issue, that the questions and concerns would be gone over in a thoughtful, deliberative manner and with some rapidity so we can concentrate on perhaps the things that matter most to Oregonians. Last comment I'd make, thank you very much. Last comment I would make for the committee is that, again, I can't emphasize enough how important this outcome prioritization process is. The agencies, as we've alluded to, the co-chairs have seen them struggle trying to put these together. Even well-intentioned, they have struggled. It is difficult to do. And I would assume that to give you some help, probably three things I would suggest maybe you use as maybe starting points, hopefully to develop even better ideas. And some have been alluded to in the governor's presentation. You know, you're going to rank them probably two or three different ways before you subjectively put that together to get your final ranking. You know, one is, of course, is it constitutionally required or the courts require it, that sort of thing. However, I would hope that would not be the be-all and end-all. I hope you would then feel free to challenge, you know, the agency's interpretation of that constitutional or judicial mandate, not to subvert it, but to see if there's a different way of getting at that in a more cost-effective way. Second, and probably most important, by my way of thinking, is this outcomes. I mean, it really is going to be tough for us to look at these agencies and say, okay, which programs actually given us the best outcomes? Our tendency is going to look at our favorite program. You know, in the textbook it says we're going to get a 1 to 15 return on investment, so therefore, boy, that's really great. I would hope we'd be thoughtful and really kind of challenge that a little bit to try and really understand, is that true? Is that, in fact, what we're getting? And most importantly, when you're looking at these agencies that actually have the outcome measures from last time, I think what will help you is if you look at how the agency prioritized these programs and then look at the outcomes, and if there's not a matchup between a high outcome and a high priority agency, that would be a question for you to ask. You know, are those priorities that the agency has truly giving you the best outcomes in that program area? So you have to marry that a little bit. And then I really do think that when push comes to shove, we're definitely not going to have enough money to do all the programs that are currently in the agencies, at least not do them well. And I would hope your goal would be not to thin the soup, but to look at, okay, gosh darn it, what programs can't we continue this time? And maybe to help you get there, you're going to have to look at three or four key outcomes for the agency you're looking at. They're going to come in with about 12 to 20-some outcomes. And some are going to be outputs, and you really need to work with your analyst to know the difference between an output and an outcome. But they're going to come in with 20 of these, and your first task in your committee is going to be establish some principles. Senator Gordley talked about this early on, some principles that you as a group will use to guide you in doing what you think are the most important outcomes, and decide on three or four of these outcomes. Yeah, these are the three or four we as a committee think are the most important. And then as you analyze these programs, use that to help guide you also. It's going to be very difficult, and I really commend you for your willingness to serve on this committee and do a good job for the citizens of the state of Oregon. And co-chairs will try and help you in any way, and if there's some interpretation that can work with you, I'll be glad to do it. Subcommittee orientation start mañana. So good luck. Go forth and do great work.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
It seems to me, following up on what you're talking about, is that the agencies are going to come in and say, this program potentially is the best program. When I talk to people at the community level, they're saying, this program isn't working. You're paying us money, and I have to circumvent it, you know, beyond my core of duties. So to me, the whole issue here is that we have to develop the most bang for the buck, and it's probably not listening to the agencies, because I think the state agencies are going to come at it from an entirely different manner than what the people at the local level or community level are going to do. And I just, you know, I just think we're looking for, in the name of that old song, we're looking for love in all the wrong places.
And Senator Nelson makes a great point, because marrying up, just because the agency comes in with their set, doesn't mean that matches yours. The thing we're doing differently here in Oregon than Washington and other states is, rather than have some focus group of unelected officials who probably represent a select group in the community that are the intelligentsia, the same old chamber, school board, you know, wonky people we always talk to, you have been elected by all Oregonians. So I'm looking to you all to be the focus group to decide what are the priorities for all Oregonians. We represent a pretty diverse group of people right here in this committee. And I think that's our strength, and that's what's going to make our effort, I think, hopefully validate the fact that the state legislature has relevance to people's day-to-day lives. And you can do a great job this session in showing the people that you do represent them, and you represent them well, and you will change the priorities based on your experience with your own people. And that's going to be the most exciting and powerful part of the process, I think.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Gruber.
Just one last note. Senator Nelson mentioned a song, and I would just ask us all to be very careful in mentioning certain songs. Representative Krupp has been known to break out in song.
No. Don't start that. No Elvis metaphors, okay, Senator? Please.
We have only a modest dress code in this committee, Senator or Representative Krupp, but let's not take advantage of it.
No leather, I promise. Okay, all right.
With that, we're adjourned. Thank you all very much.
You're going to have to start doing some Roy Orbison just to...